and this morning as we were talking about economic disparity that I believe will probably always exist among the people of God. We looked at some examples from the first century, from the church in Jerusalem in its beginning days, to the church at Corinth, to the church at Ephesus, to dispersed Christians whom James addressed in his epistle. We looked at examples where there were admonitions given to brethren who were from different socioeconomic levels in life to look at material things properly, but more than that, look at each other properly, to properly assess other brothers and sisters in Christ, and to use the values of God, not the status symbols of this life, to appreciate, to understand one another. The challenge we have in this society is to deal with economic disparity in a wealthy society. And we made the point this morning that even perhaps the poorest of most of the citizens of the United States live well above the means of so many other people throughout the world. And I'm not sure what that means, except that perhaps it might mean that it brings some perspective to need or poverty or what we define as being poor. And so we need to be careful how we define ourselves as being economically disadvantaged or being wealthy or not. And thus we need to be careful how we might tend to categorize other people in our own category or in the other category. So we talked about some basic principles as to how God looks at us relative to material things. And tonight we're going to move a little bit further into the discussion. If you can see that. And we're going to talk, first of all, about problems that arise among those who might see themselves, or society, in fact, might see them as being economically disadvantaged. Would you turn to Proverbs chapter 14? We talked about assigning values, the rich toward the poor toward the rich. Not just simply characterizing others in terms of what they possess or they don't, but assigning value terms to them. Well, unfortunately, this is a reality of life. And the reality of life regarding those who might be considered by society poor, again, however we define that, one of the realities of life is that those who are poor are often victims of injustice. It is a sad commentary on our justice system in a nation, among all nations of the world, that purports to be fair. In fact, the motto over the Supreme Court building is equal justice to all. It does not say justice for all. It is the promise of dispensing equal justice, equal standards of justice. Now, let me tell you, that doesn't happen. It just doesn't. The rich can buy decisions of the court. It happens all the time. Read the newspaper. If you have money, you can influence a court. You can influence it a number of ways. You can influence juries who might hold your fate in their hands. Prejudice is going to be exhibited toward those that are poor, and instill within them, possibly, feelings of inferiority. And thus, because society tends to look so disfavorably upon the poor, it tends to kill any zeal that they might have to see themselves in any kind of a proper light, see themselves perhaps as God would see them, or to be inspired to live above their circumstances. Proverbs chapter 14, in verse 20, "The poor man is hated even by his own neighbor, but the rich has many friends." Proverbs 19, verses 6 and 7. "Many entreat the favor of the nobility, and every man is a friend to one who gives gifts. All the brothers of the poor hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He may pursue them with words, yet they abandon him." I chose those proverbs, and there's lots of proverbs, by the way, on socioeconomic standards and the outcome of those standards. But these passages just indicate, I think in a broader sense, society's negative view toward those who are considered poor. And so this is something that people are going to have to deal with. How do I look at myself properly when society may identify me in this unkind and unfair way? Well, turning to the New Testament, I'd like you to look at John chapter 6, page 718 in the Pew Bible. John 6, you probably recognize as a chapter of great consequence, because this is where Jesus challenges the multitudes who are following him on a deeper spiritual level, and they fail the challenge. But I want you to notice in verse 26 what Jesus notes about the multitudes who have been following him. Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." One of the problems that comes to those who are poor relative to their response to the gospel is to try to understand their honesty in coming to the Lord. Am I doing it for advantage? Do I respond to the truths of God because they might help me get ahead? Because it associates me with people perhaps above my social station? In short, do I see godliness as a way of gain? It's easy to take advantage of the compassion and the generosity of other people. And the people here in John 6 are doing that to Jesus. And he knows they're doing that. They're not doing it without Jesus' understanding of that. But it comes to a point where he draws the line. I don't know what he was thinking. Was he thinking that I've given them sufficient time to see spiritual truth before challenging them as he does in this chapter, which inevitably makes them turn away? But whatever Jesus' motives were and whatever his understanding of the crowds were, it's clear by what he says to them that they had begun to look at him as a way of gain. And thus their own spirituality was compromised. It was exposed here as being insincere. And so the question that might come to those who are poor as they come to the gospel is, why am I responding to the gospel? Is it because I really love God? Or is it a step up, perhaps, in society with those that I'll be associating with? I think it's a very real issue that people will have to deal with. Envy, I think, also becomes an issue among those that are poor. There's the perception that everyone else has more than I do. Everyone else seems secure in their lives. Everybody else seems to be prospering. Very often, that is not reality. It is simply a perception. But it's a perception that grows out of envy. I perceive that others, and again, maybe it's not just what they have materially, but we begin assigning value to those that possess more. And so we might, those that are poor, disadvantaged economically, might tend to start undermining through envy those that they perceive are above them. And I think that the tendency among the people of God for this sort of envy to be shown is what comes out in criticism, in gossip, in alienating oneself from others and avoiding them because of this sense of envy, perhaps, that takes root within us. In fact, I wonder if the root of a lot of criticism is not produced from envy, that it's a desire to take someone perceived to be above me down a notch and make myself feel better because that perceived disparity between me and them is very uncomfortable. And I think envy is a hard thing to recognize within ourselves. It's not a very flattering thing to acknowledge about yourself, that you're envious of, in this case, someone's material prosperity. You might envy other things in others. But in this regard especially, I think it becomes a problem. Why should they have more than me? I work hard too, and I've invested myself in trying to accumulate the necessities of life in a comfortable way. Why should they have an income 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times more than me and live in that neighborhood and et cetera, et cetera? If we're not careful, that can worm its way into our attitudes, into our thoughts, and we can, in fact, rot from within because of such attitudes. Well, those are some problems among the poor and or disadvantaged. What about the advantages? And we might say, how in the world can you come up with any advantages to not having, at least as one might perceive to be, enough? Well, in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus speaks about the nature of material things in sort of some disparaging ways. He talks about moths and rust and thieves. And he says that the material things of life are subject to removal or decay. They're unstable. They're uncertain. And so what can happen is we might be distracted the more we have by the material things of life and find that our focus on God has been compromised along the way. I don't think this argument probably goes very far with the disadvantaged, because I think the response probably is, I would love to have the chance to be distracted by those things. I think I could handle it. You know, I would love to win the lottery. I would love to become a millionaire, because in spite of what the Bible says about the dangers of riches, I think I could handle it. And so for those that are in a position of being disadvantaged in some way, I think there is the perception that, oh, please let me have a chance to be distracted. I'd love to take that on. And there's not a realistic understanding from experience that the more we have and the more we accumulate, the more stressful it becomes. And I'll say something more about that when we turn this around and look at it the other way. Turn with me to Deuteronomy 8, page 129 in the Pew Bible. I think this is a really good, insightful chapter on human psychology. Human psychology in relation to partly the possessions of life. That's dealt with here. But it's partly whether I see myself as being secure in this world or I see myself as being insecure in this world. And, you know, without being a psychologist or psychiatrist, I do think it is very helpful for us to study from the Scriptures human nature, what we tend to do in responding to certain stimuli. And this is what we find in Deuteronomy 8. It's how the Israelites are responding to their conditions of life. And we have a contrast here in Deuteronomy 8. We'll deal with the first part of the contrast now and the second part of it in a minute. But look at verses 2 through 5, Deuteronomy 8. This is anticipating the people coming into the land of Canaan. You shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you and to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Did you remember we sang that tonight? Man shall not live by bread alone. This is where it comes from. And God is wanting the Israelites to understand this principle, and how does he go about doing it? By depriving them. Your garments did not wear out on you, verse 4, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. So you should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. The advantage of having less in this life, however you're going to define less, but feeling like you don't have enough, the advantage of that is it's a great way for God to develop a sense of dependence on him. Because it's so easy for us to transfer that sense of dependence to other things. It may be to our education, it may be to our health, it may be to our money, it may be to our retirement account, it may be to our home. I mean, we can transfer the sense of dependence we ought to have on God to other substitutes. It's harder to do that when you don't have a lot. Because likely, if I don't have a lot, I'm going to be psychologically affected by that. What I mean by that is it's hard to feel confident. It's hard to feel self-assured when I'm struggling. You know, poverty works on us emotionally and mentally, psychologically, if we let it. Doesn't have to, but if you let it, it will. And so when I'm in a position of want or need, it is an outward circumstance that drives us back to this question of who do we depend on? Who is our strength? What's the foundation of my life? And I would never put myself in the life that I've lived in the position of being poor. You know, my father died when I was at a young age, and there were some days financially in those early times where my mother literally did not know on Friday where the food would come from on Monday. I didn't know that was going on. But having said that, I would not put myself in that category of being poor or disadvantaged. The Lord took care of it. However, there were times in life, such as then and maybe later, when I was more aware of what was going on, where I certainly understood that my confidence was not in my bank account. My confidence was not in my ingenuity or talent to make a quick fortune. I mean, haven't we all been there at some point without classifying ourselves as being poor, which I think is hard to do in this country? But nonetheless, there have been times where we've wondered, how am I going to make it through this financially? And the Lord provides. And it's a good time. It's not pleasant, but it's a good time because it forces us back to some of these more basic issues of life. Who am I depending on? And this is what God's saying to the Israelites about their conditions in wandering through the wilderness. I did this to test you and make it plain to you within your own heart who you were depending on. So there is an advantage into feeling a sense of need, driving us back to God. Well, I think another advantage is it helps us to serve in ways that engage the person. What I mean by that is if we don't have monetarily or materially the wherewithal to contribute to the needs of other people, we're going to have to contribute in other ways. And perhaps those are the most important ways. I'm not saying that financially helping people is not important. What I am saying is, can't you again look at your own life and see that so much prosperity has come to you because of what somebody else contributed to you in their person, in their character, in their time they've spent with you, in the prayers they've uttered with you, the studies they've engaged in with you. And perhaps those are the most significant things to give someone else. Perhaps it's not a question of opening up the wallet and giving money out of our abundance. It's being personally involved with other people so that you're contributing to their betterment spiritually and emotionally. Well, those that are disadvantaged don't have full wallets to open up and hand somebody a 20. So how do you contribute? Do you just say, well, I don't have anything to contribute? Or do you find ways that engage the person? Well, let's talk about some problems among the rich and or, we might say, the comfortable in this life. Well, look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5, page 451, the Pew Bible. I touched on this earlier in my comments about distractions, but the more materially wrapped up we are in this life, the more inroads Satan seems to make into creating anxiety between us. There's just a lot more to worry about in this life because the opportunity to worry about more things has come up. When we didn't have as much accumulation, we didn't have as much anxiety about maintaining it, investing it, making it prosper, making sure that it's working for us, perhaps. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Now, let me ask you a question. Can you identify with that verse, with that principle in Ecclesiastes? Or is our impression of things that the more we have, the more at ease we are emotionally? that the people who have more to worry about in this life are the people who are without, and the people who have an abundance, why, they're the ones that are at peace within themselves. I think that's probably most of our generic outlook on life. But you know, this principle is exactly the opposite of that. It's with abundance we have greater anxiety and sleep escapes from us, because we're worried about our retention of it. Why do we tend to worry? Because we inherently know what Jesus taught in Matthew 6. Moth and rust and thieves. That's why. Oil goes up. Stock market goes down. We know those things happen. What looks, you know, on paper one day to be wealth, give it a month and it might appear to be rather different. We know that. We know there's insecurity in those material things, and yet sometimes we still tend to pursue them. Well, let's go back to the Deuteronomy 8 passage. God deals with the Israelites early, as we've already read, with their conditions in the wilderness. And what he does later in the chapter is he's warning them, Moses doing the bidding of God, here's warning them about what's potentially going to happen to their outlook on things when they get into the land of Canaan and they inherit the great blessings that God has had for them through all of the hundreds and hundreds of years that have transpired since the promises to Abraham. Pick it up with me in verse 7, Deuteronomy chapter 8. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. Verse 11, beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and the statutes which I command you today, lest when you've eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses to dwell in, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you and do good to you in the end. Then you say in your heart, in verse 17, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. And you shall remember the Lord your God. And it's he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. What a great passage on human psychology. And what I mean by that is the emotional and mental reactions that we have to God by virtue of the things of this world. The material things of this life have a powerful effect on the way we view God. It's kind of hard, you know, to see that connection or understand why it should be that way. But God knows it's that way. And here's the interesting thing you might want to argue in looking at a passage like this. If material things have the tendency to do this to you, why does God ever let us prosper? Why did he want to give a land flowing with milk and honey? Why did he want to give houses already built and cities with walls around? Why did God want to do that for the people if he knew that they would react potentially in a negative way? Well, you know, it's not the material things themselves. We have a choice to make as to how we respond to God. Whether I have little or I have much, I have a choice as to how I respond to God. And God does not want us to suffer in this life. That's not really what it's about. God understands that because of what we are, suffering can be helpful. But that's because we're not ideal. God wants us to have, I'm not preaching the gospel of health and wealth here, God wants us to have good things. And I'm not talking about Cadillacs. I'm talking about he wants us to be blessed people. But he doesn't ever want those blessings to be an impediment to our spirituality. So it's as if God just keeps on, I wonder what he's going to do with it this time. Okay, I'm going to let him prosper. Wonder what he's going to do with it. Is he going to keep trusting me? Or is he going to let those material things get in the way? And volumes have been written about the greater challenge of our faith coming from prosperity than coming from poverty. And I think that's true. I think it's been observed correctly that more people can handle poverty and be spiritually wealthy than can handle prosperity. What was 1 Corinthians 1 from the lesson this morning? Who had the gospel been received by the most, as Paul wrote Corinthians? Not the wise and the mighty and the noble who are called. There's tremendous danger. There's the danger of self-sufficiency in the material blessings, and not just material, but that's what we're talking about today, but the other blessings of life, the other successes of life. There's the tendency for us to feel self-sufficient. Also, the rich, the self-sufficient, see themselves often as being the privileged ones. The law doesn't apply to me. This could be very subjective. When you're on 285 or 85 or 75 or 20 and cars go flying past you, which I hope they're doing, not the reverse, are they usually junkers? I mean, this may be my subjective opinion. I totally admit that. Seems like to me the cars that blow me off the road are big, fancy SUVs or Mercedes or BMW. I mean, am I making that up? Is it not the case that much of the time in our society that the wealthy and the powerful, the two go hand in hand, see themselves as the privileged ones? And perhaps not subject to the law. Used to having their own way, used to influencing other people. Not perhaps seeing themselves as being dependent people, but others being dependent on them, being self-sufficient. Well, a lack of compassion, I think, can accompany the wealthy. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4, you see your brother in need and shut up your heart from him. You notice John's terminology here? He doesn't just talking about shutting up your wallet. He says, if you see your brother in need and shut up your heart from him. Remember what we said this morning, if you were here, about the value judgments that we tend to make? It's not just this man over here has less than I have. It's that I tend to look at him and say, he's got to be more ignorant than I am. He's got to be less educated than me. He's got to be lazier than me. Because he's got less. And it might be that one of the problems that come with having an abundance is lacking compassion for others. When you might think it would be the opposite. You might think that the more we have, the more compassionate we would be on those that have not. But I wonder if that is the case. Well, the advantages might be fairly obvious. Ideally, if we have a sufficiency or maybe even an abundance, ideally, we should have more time and energy to devote to the things of God because the necessities of life are supplied. Is that the way it is with you? Do you feel like that because of all the modern conveniences that you own, that your time is freed up to contribute to the welfare of others? I'd be surprised if many of us said, yes, I find that to be the case. I have much more time now that I can microwave supper. And I don't have to go to a laundromat, and I've got my washer and dryer right there with me, and I can Swiffer or Hoover or whatever it is I'm going to do, flip the switch and have it suck up all the dirt. How easy is that? Ooh, I'm going to get it over that one probably. It's not easy. But what I'm saying is, do all these time-saving conveniences mean that we've got an abundance of time for the Lord or for His people? And so ideally, there should be more time in opportunity that comes from having an abundance, not having to perhaps overwork ourselves in order to have the necessities of life. But so often it seems that we might tend to squander the extra time and opportunity that may come from an abundance. Sharing with others in order to glorify God. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 10 through 13. This is, of course, about the contribution that's being taken to Jerusalem from Gentile brethren and being offered to Jewish brethren. We talked about Jew-Gentile prejudice a little bit in the lesson this morning. But what I want you to see out of this reference in 2 Corinthians 9 is what actually springs from this sharing one to another in the family of God. 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 10, "Now may he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness, while you are enriched in everything with all liberality, which causes thanksgiving through us to God. For the administration of this service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgivings to God. While through the proof of this ministry, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession to the gospel of Christ and for your liberal sharing with them and with all men." In other words, it's not merely that our abundance enables us to help our brother who's in need. That's alone a good thing. But Paul really sets his sight on something higher than that. It's that God would be glorified when those who are in need have that need supplied. Perhaps, as in this case, by strangers. Strangers that live a long way away. Or, as in the case here, strangers who are actually very poor, as Paul says to the Macedonians early in chapter 8. I mean, how would you feel if very, very, very poor brethren in another third world country scraped together what little they have, and the excess of the little they have, and sent it to you to help alleviate a need that you had? Would that not make you fall to your knees and thank God for people like that? I mean, isn't it God that made those people like that? That kind of generosity doesn't usually come from human nature. It comes from divine nature. Haven't you ever had cause to thank God for people that stepped into your life and helped you when you were really down? I did have an experience many, many years ago, pre-Melanie, when I lived in Nevada. And I, single, fell on some financially hard times. I was ill and couldn't work. And some folks in the church out there stepped in and provided an automobile for me to get around in for a while and did some other very nice things. Don't you? I was thankful for them, but boy, I was thankful to God that through His people, He was providing for my needs. And so the advantage here in having the things of this world is to reflect more glory on God, because He's the one that teaches us to be generous and thoughtful of others. Well, in the last few minutes of the lesson, let me just share with you some general overriding principles. And the first one I'm going to admit is not a pleasant one. But I'll tell you, God says a pretty good bit about this in the Scriptures. Poverty sometimes results from laziness. And I'm not suggesting that's true of anybody in particular, or if we find ourselves in need in life, which all of us will, probably at one time or another. We don't know where the next mortgage payment's coming from, or the next meal may be coming from. And circumstances happen. At the same time, I think a good bit of the poverty, especially that exists in our own country, not only comes from inactivity and a lack of industry, but our society often produces it because of social programs. But look at Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 4. "He who deals with a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes one rich." Proverbs 13 and verse 23. "Much food is in the fallow ground of the poor, and for lack of justice there's waste." You know what he's saying there? There's food in principle sitting in the ground. If the lazy man would get up and plow and sow and reap and prepare, he would have something to eat. Oftentimes the lack that he has comes from inactivity. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, there's the command there to withdraw from brethren who will not work. And eating is tied to working. If a man doesn't work, neither let him eat. Also in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. So here's a man who has made his living previously by stealing. Wonder how open we would be to a brother who had made his living by criminal theft. And yet, apparently, there were some in the church in Ephesus who came from that background. Well, what's the point? Be gainfully employed. Work not only to provide for your own needs, but the needs of other people. So, one thing that we as God's people should attend to is industrious labor. To see that we're not a burden on others, for one, but at the same time, to have for ourselves that which we can contribute to others. And I think if our heart is right, that certainly is what we would desire in life, ideally. Secondly, I think contentment with what we have is a challenge to all of us. I don't think it's a challenge to those who are without. I think it's a challenge to everybody, regardless of our socioeconomic level, because essentially it's an attitude. It really doesn't have, I think, a lot to do with how much money's in the bank. It's got to do with an attitude toward God. 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. I've said before in sermons, what a challenge that is. I mean, look at verse 8. Having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Wow, does that describe me? Are my worries on the basis of what I'm going to eat or where I'm going to live? Or are my anxieties and worries on all those other things we've already said in this lesson come with abundance? I would think that probably most of us, in honesty, would not simply be content with the necessities. We're wanting plasma TVs. Or other, perhaps, frivolous things. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11, Paul says, I have learned to be content. I think that's a wonderful insight, too, into human nature. I've learned to be content. I don't think it comes naturally to most people. I think it's something we have to consciously work on and develop. And perhaps it's something that needs a lot of work the more we accumulate. How content would I be if I lost it all? Of course, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, I think I can handle that. Okay, then how much are you worrying about losing it? Is that an indicator of how content you would be if you didn't have it? I think we have a strange sort of situation that happens in this regard. I think it's easy for the wealthy, those that have an abundance, to sense the vanity of those things and long for a simpler life. Haven't thought this through. Hope it applies. Have you seen the commercial where the guy is selling the antique cars in the barn? And he's saying something to the effect of, yeah, I just want to enjoy life before it's too late, or however he phrases that. And the guy that comes in to buy the barn with all the antique cars in is saying, yeah, I wanted to kind of reach out for my dream before it becomes too late. I mean, they were each viewing the same thing from a totally different point of view. And I think that's kind of what happens when we consider material things. I think the wealthy, they've had an opportunity to see that these things aren't fulfilling. They brought anxieties and they brought worries, and they've had to maintain it and upkeep it and insure it and everything else we've got to do with wealthy possessions. And they look at that at some point in life and they say, you know, I just wish I could go sit on the side of a mountain somewhere in a small little cabin and just sit out and enjoy the quiet. And those who don't have an abundance look at the wealth and say, wow, I'd really like to have, as we said, those distractions. I'd really like to have those anxieties. I'd like to try that just once. I think contentment is something that comes from within and is not really based on the amount of the things that we possess. I'm going to hasten on here. Serve as we're called. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 20 through 24. Actually, the context there is talking about being either slaves or free. But I think there is an application and principle here. And the idea is that I can serve God wherever I happen to be economically. Wherever I am on that scale of either being disadvantaged or I have an abundance, I can serve God wherever I am and whatever state I am. And Paul says to those who are either free or slaves, be content to stay in the situation you're in. I mean, if you can change your situation and you think it would be advantageous to serve in the Lord, fine, change it. But don't fall into the trap of thinking, well, I could be a better servant if only I had more money, were free instead of a slave or whatever. God can take us and use us wherever we are in life, economically or any other way. Wealth, as we alluded to this morning, is not a de facto sign of God's approval. Maybe a sign of Satan's approval. It's how we're going to handle that. On the other hand, I think God will approve of our wealth if it's being used to His glory. We should not read it as God's approval of our life. But certainly if we do prosper by God's hand, that's approved if we're using it to His glory. Poverty does not excuse sin. I'd like to dwell on that point a little bit more. I'm not going to say much about it. But one of the main thoughts in our world, our worldview, popular word today. What's your worldview? Well, I'll tell you, one of the planks of the worldview, if you're in poverty, you have a license to do anything you want. That's often the explanation behind Islam. And I read an interesting article on that the other day. But it's not the poverty-stricken Islamic people who are blowing themselves up in order to kill other people. They're educated and they're wealthy, by and large. But there's this prevailing notion in our society that if you're poor, the rules don't apply to you. And it's a justification for violence. It's a justification for destruction of property. It's a justification for doing whatever you want to do because you're disadvantaged. I tell you, God never gives us a free pass on that. God never justifies flagrantly violating the law, or subtly violating it for that matter, or doing ill to your fellow man because you're financially disadvantaged. God doesn't give us a free pass for that. But yet, that's a major, major plank in the worldview of our society, in Western thought in general. I do want to close with this verse from Matthew chapter 25, or passage rather. Matthew 25, this is interesting because I think what Jesus in part is saying here is the test of your true feelings toward Christ are going to come out in your true feelings toward other people. And we really can't separate these two things. Oh, well, you know, I love the Lord. I want to be like Jesus. I want to be like Jesus. But I'm going to treat my fellow man like dirt. It can't be that way. Whether I love Jesus is going to come out in how I treat not only just my fellow man, but those who belong to Jesus. That's really one of the main tests. John talks about this in somewhat lengthy passages in 1 John. But Matthew chapter 25 and verse 34, the king will say to those on his right hand, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in? Or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." And then he follows with the negative of that principle. If you didn't do it for those who were in need, who belonged to me, you didn't serve me. And so there's a real serious question of spirituality here. And it is going to be resolved in how we view, in this case, those who are disadvantaged, how we're using the things that God's blessed us with in this life for the sake of others. One thing I'd like you to see in the lessons today is there's danger on both sides. We ended with the Proverbs 30 passage this morning. I didn't re-show it, but in essence, the proverb says, Lord, don't give me either extreme. Wealth that I may forget you, poverty that I may be tempted to steal and bring reproach on the purity of your character. But there again, isn't contentment at issue and isn't that an attitude? It's how I choose to develop within myself a value system that properly looks at what the Lord's blessed me with. I think the challenges here are great. And perhaps it's a challenge even in places, maybe at Embry Hills, to congregational unity. A challenge as to whether we really do want to be like Jesus, as is said so often here, verbally. Well, that's one of the ways we're going to find out.